Hello, and welcome to Power Pros Podcast, Episode 17, Season of Flame. I am one of your co-hosts, the Hoff, Chris Hoffman, and with me is my lackey, Chris Slate.
Hello.
And we're here once again to talk about Nintendo. Our big topic this week is going to be the weird and wild world of game reviews and game review scores. But we've also got a ton of Nintendo news to talk about, so we're going to kick it off with that. First of all, we got some pretty lousy news recently, and that is that one of the big Nintendo holiday games is going to be delayed. It's coming out sometime next year, and that is Star Fox Zero, falling out of its holiday release date and into the unknown of 2016.
Yeah, this is doubly kind of hard because it was originally going to be kind of the B game to Zelda Wii U title, which was going to be the holiday game.
Yeah.
And, Miyamoto and Anuma infamously kind of appeared in a video late last year, I believe, showing, mm-hmm. you know, talking about both titles while they showed a playthrough demonstration of the new Zelda and basically guaranteeing that both games would come out this year.
Yep.
So when Zelda fell through, everybody thought, well, at least we're still getting Star Fox, you know, and it's not a Zelda replacement, but, you know, it's something. And now that's fallen through as well. But, you know, nobody likes to see a game delayed, but in this case, maybe it'll be for the best.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely disappointing that we're not going to be getting it this year, but I don't think anyone was really, you know, blown away by it when they saw it at E3. I know I wasn't. It seemed serviceable. But, you know, I don't really want Star Fox to just be serviceable. I would much rather that it be, you know, a real wow game that really, really impresses people and, you know, does make them, you know, see all the cool features of the gamepad and looks great. And, you know, this isn't just some, you know, nostalgia franchise, but something that could really come out and stand on its own and, you know, just be really cool for, you know, all types of Nintendo players, whether you remember it from the Super NES days or not.
And that's something this series has needed for a while. It's you know, it's only ever had one kind of universally acclaimed installment, being Star Fox 64. Mm-hmm. And the last few games have kind of been hit or miss, although people do still, and I am certainly a fan, I do still have, despite some of the lackluster titles, kind of a fondness for the characters in that universe. And I really want to see it reestablish itself as a top franchise. So, you know, maybe this is what it needs. Mr. Miyamoto, who's really overseeing the game closely, you know, issued a statement where he talked about, you know, in decent specifics about how they really want to make sure that this game really showcases that second screen possibility in a way that people are going to respond favorably to. And that seemed to be the most divisive element of it after people played it at E3 and some other shows.
Yeah, I mean, when I played it, you know, the thing I came away with the most was this is going to take a lot of practice and learning. You know, just using the gamepad in the way they intended isn't super intuitive. And that was my main takeaway. So hopefully they're doing a lot of refinement, making it, you know, simpler to pick up and play and just, you know, making an overall more enjoyable experience.
Yeah. What do you think, though? I mean, you know, we always want to see stuff early, and especially when, you know, this year we had long periods of drought. It was nice to see, you know, here's a little promise of things to come. But if Nintendo can't, you know, deliver on these release dates, should they kind of keep quiet or at least not announce release dates until they're much closer to being done?
I don't think so. I mean, especially when you're talking about a company like Nintendo, where, you know, you never really know what's coming. And, you know, just, you know, the way that Nintendo is seen in video games right now, they're, you know, as the third place player, you know, what's coming down the road, they have to really show everything they got and be like, yeah, there's lots of really good stuff coming if they want people to buy their system. So I think it is important to get out there early. But, yeah, it would be nice if they did stick a little closer to those projected dates.
Right, and in case anyone missed it, Miyamoto did mention that he's targeting the first quarter of next year for the game to finally come out. He made no guarantees, yeah. Which is probably for the best at this point. Their track record isn't so great in that area lately, but hopefully it does come out then, and hopefully, you know, maybe if we're lucky, the graphics will have received a little bit of an extra polish too, because that seemed to be another area that a lot of people had issue with.
Yeah, to be honest, Mario Maker, you know, is probably going to be their biggest seller for the holiday season anyway. And aside from that, I know we have Xenoblade Chronicles X coming, and like that's probably going to eat up all my game playing time after that happens. So I think Star Fox would have been pushed to the background for me, definitely. Has a better shot of me actually spending some quality time with it if it comes out next year.
Yeah, I am so in love with Mario Maker, and you know, I still want to keep up with my Splatoon playing, which I've fallen off a bit of lately. And then we've still got Yoshi coming out next month.
Oh, that's right.
So, and also Amiibo has filled the gap. So strangely, I kind of am not too upset about this. I feel like, you know, Mario Maker really, if anything, is kind of the big holiday game by default. Mm-hmm, and it, right. I really feel like it deserves to be. And I think more than anything, more than missing Star Fox, if Nintendo were to just do a price drop this Christmas, I think the library that's out there is already solid enough for
people.
That'd
probably be a big help.
Yeah, and people have probably been hearing about Mario Maker and Splatoon for a while now, and a bunch of people would jump on board this Christmas if they just brought that price down a little bit. It's probably the best thing they could do, even better than having a Star Fox available.
My biggest concern about the Star Fox delay is what it means for the Falco Amiibo. I was afraid, and I was hoping to get my whole collection of default Smash Brothers characters this year. I was like, is he going to get delayed until that product comes out next year? I'm not quite sure. Although they did, I think, give an official release date for it already, and I think pre-orders went up in Europe. So at least some people seem to think that it's still, coming out this year.
I would guess that they'll probably stick to that plan. And if we're lucky, maybe with the extra time, they'll deliver on those transformable R-Wing Amiibo that Miyamoto was talking about potentially trying at last E3.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
Well, we talked a little bit about Mario Maker just a second ago, but let's get into it even further. We've both been playing it quite a bit since the release date, and I know you have a lot of additional thoughts about the game.
Yeah, I stressed and stressed about delivering the most perfect first level that I could, and I finally put it up. I know you got a few levels out before me, and they were all great. For some reason, I was just really slow on it.
Yeah, but I wasn't going crazy like you were. I was still just trying to use the early themes, and I still haven't gone nuts and done a level that's got like all the possibility. I was sticking to like, here's one with the first batch, here's one with the second batch. And I went up to the airship, and I still have to make a ghost house level with the Super Mario World theme. I haven't done that. But you, unlocked everything, and now you're trying just to put together, some really, really creative levels.
Well, it's interesting. We took very different approaches. You tried to kind of master the more bread-and-butter elements of Mario.
Right.
And when you play your levels, it really feels like that. These feel like they could be from an actual Mario game, and they're kind of comforting in that way. I focused more on the let's take one kind of zany idea, build some memorable kind of mechanisms out of it, something that stands out. I kind of fell into that camp where it was like, what would Nintendo not do? And let's play in that area. And as a result, I think I came up with some really clever parts of a level, but there wasn't maybe enough kind of tried and true glue holding them all together. And it was interesting because if you don't have anyone around locally to play test these things, you put them up, and for me, this level, I knew it so well, like the back of my hand, I could beat it, with my eyes closed. I put it up, and now I think currently only 5% of the people, 5% of the times people have played it, they've completed it, and everyone's telling me it's really difficult. So so I'm going to go back in, tweak it a bit, and put it back up. And I was happy to just discover that I won't lose my stars. Obviously, the new version of the level won't have those same stars that I'd earned, but they'll still
will.
Be associated
You'll
with
have
my
them.
Profile. Yeah, and they'll still count toward upping my limit of levels that I can post.
Yeah, your level was all about using buzzy beetles in creative ways. You can, wear their shells on your head. You can ride on them. And to be honest, I hadn't used the buzzy beetle very much. And so when I played your level, I wasn't quite sure what to do at first. But, the nice thing about it is that when you're just playing an individual level, you can just keep trying over and over again. And there was a little bit of trial and error. But it was a really cool, fun gimmick, and I enjoyed replaying it, even though I made some goofy mistakes right off the bat. I think the very first thing I did was I kicked a beetle shell the wrong way, and I was like, now I can't even get off the first screen.
Yeah.
And I just died on a giant Koopa on some spikes.
All right, now you really have to anticipate. I mean, it makes you appreciate, we kind of touched on this last week, but it makes you appreciate things from a game developer's point of view and all the things they have to take into consideration in making a great level. And one thing that I keep in mind, I've played a lot of, 100 Mario Challenge, and I've been struggling to get through expert mode for two reasons. One, expert mode, you'd think it's like, okay, here's some finely honed, levels that are really tailored for people that have great Mario skills. Actually, it's mostly just the junk that it was so poorly made, it's near unbeatable. And
unless you're the creator, you're probably not going to be able to beat it.
Yeah.
And there's some levels that the creators can barely beat themselves.
Yeah, I think I played my last attempt at it. I got to 12 levels out of the 16 needed, and I think out of those 12 levels, I only starred one of them because I thought, okay, this level in particular was hard, but But it was clever and it was fair. It was just, you know, it was a real test. The other ones are, you know, bad just because they're too unpredictable, or, you know, whoever played through it to legitimize the upload, you know, just kept beating their head against the wall until they finally got lucky and broke through. They're just not, a lot of them aren't very fun. So I'm not enjoying the expert mode of that just yet. I'm hopeful that, you know, as more people play the games and the algorithm collects more data, some of that stuff might be weeded out in favor of the more, you know, the harder levels that still have a lot of stars and positive feedback. So we'll see on that. But yeah, it makes me think about my own level and think, well, you know, I don't want to just count on people playing it over and over again, because you can easily skip it if you're playing, if my level were to turn up in 100 Mario Challenge. So, you know, I want to make something that is challenging but fair. And
yeah,
not,
you want it to be fun if they do encounter it in the 100 Mario Challenge. Like, you know, if you just are playing it on your own, you don't mind dying a whole bunch of times and, you know, getting through it, you know, through some trial and error. But that's a little less fun when you have, you know, 15 other levels to play through and you have, you know, not an infinite number of lives to go around.
Yeah. And speaking of feeling like what it's like to be a developer, I kind of went through all the stages of it, putting my first level up. I did a little, you know, promotion on Twitter to make people aware. You know, I tweeted out through the Power Pros podcast account. You know, go check this level out if you get a chance. And then I sat back and kind of waited for the first reviews and, you know, was excited to see people's comments when they were positive and, you know, really kind of stressed out about it when they weren't. So, you know, it was really fun to go through the whole process of creating something, you know, and just, again, seeing what it's like from the other side, having worked in games press for so many years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my other big takeaway from the game, though, is just how, you know, vast and full of possibilities it is. Like, the more I play, the more I discover that, you know, it seems like almost everything has a secondary version. If you shake it, you can combine things in really creative ways, you know, by you know, combining mushrooms with enemies and enemies with other enemies, and, you know, stacking enemies on enemies and enemies on obstacles and all that stuff. And it's just, it's way more, there's way more to it than I initially thought. You know, even after playing, you know, several hours and making a couple of levels, you know, every time it's like, oh wow, look at all these creative possibilities. It just, you know, gets cooler and cooler as you learn that stuff.
Yeah, but between my son's profile and mine, we've totaled up almost 100 hours on it so far.
Jeez.
And a lot of that time was spent just kind of monkeying around, making quick one-off stuff to kind of for each other to play just for fun. But I also feel like I've just barely scratched the surface of this thing. I mean, and I think the key to making some fun levels isn't just throwing everything in the kitchen sink into one level, but kind of limiting your choices, coming up with a theme, and really exploring a few different elements, you know, in a level. And pretty much everything in my tool set I've yet to kind of dive that deeply with, except for the beetle shell, which I based that whole level around. So I just imagine I'm going to be happily playing this for the rest of the year. And, you know, that'll help get over the disappointment about Star Fox and Zelda for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, presumably you have a Wii U, and, you know, this is a game that you totally got to get.
That's right. I mean, obviously, it's really catered towards, you know, creative types, but even if you just want to play and have fun, it's still a must-have, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Excellent game. Another excellent game is Super Smash Bros., and we saw some interesting rumors about that game recently. I can't really say I'm going to get behind these rumors myself. They seem very suspect, but, you know, it was some fun, interesting stuff to see online. Of course, I'm talking about, you know, these alleged inclusions of, you know, a bunch of indie characters and stages and things like that. Shovel Knight, in particular, as a playable character, a Runbo stage, you know, like a Shantae wig and things like that. What did you think when you saw this?
Well, my first thought was, well, first of all, the thing that got people talking was there are some images, there are some supposed screenshots of a lot of the the screens showing these things being unlocked in Smash Brothers. They look very legit. I mean,
They do, but we've seen lots of legit-looking things before for both Smash and Mario Kart, and so anytime I see that stuff, I am very, very wary.
People have gotten very skilled at faking that stuff. But my first thought was, well, I just can't see these characters appearing in the game because, first of all, the indie scene is still relatively small as far as like general awareness amongst the audience. And also, you're talking about these titles, Shovel Knight and Shantae and things like that, pretty much unknown in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's hard to imagine a Japanese publisher and Sakurai in general choosing these characters. I mean, the Japanese Smash community didn't really know who Little Mac was.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I can't imagine they'd be thrilled about hearing, you know, character slots being taken up by American indie games.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, when I saw it all as a package, I thought, well, if Nintendo wants to show a lot of indie love, this is kind of a cool way to do it. And taken all together, I thought maybe I was okay with it, even though I don't know that a lot of them have really earned their place the pantheon of classic Smash characters.
That would be my complaint if it were real, that it's like, you know, this is the Nintendo All-Stars game, and to throw in something from, you know, just a, like a brand new character from a brand new title that's only been around for a month or so doesn't really scream All-Stars to me, doesn't really fit with what Smash Bros. Is all about. Although I do, you know, love seeing the indies get their recognition.
Yeah, so I could have gone either way. I mean, maybe we'll still see, Shovel Knight or someone appear.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he's in it, but I guess we'll have to see.
Yeah, but specifically about this rumor, it does appear to have been debunked in a couple of different ways. People have looked at the font used in the supposed screenshots and said it doesn't quite match up with the actual in-game font. Someone has also claimed that the 3D model of Shovel Knight that appears in the screenshots was something that they had created and someone else had taken and used. So, you know, again, we don't know, you know, this guy who said that he created the 3D model. We don't necessarily know that he's trustworthy either.
Mm-hmm,
but
all
of it adds up to just feel like it's probably not going to happen.
Remember there was that one leak from Mario Kart where, you know, there were some levels that went out. He's like, oh, no, that's just fake. I faked. And it turned out it was real.
Oh, yeah.
So, you could never tell.
Yeah. It's a big, the internet just wants to troll you when it comes to cool new Nintendo stuff.
Yes, they do. Now, last week, there was a topic I really wanted to cover, but I totally forgot, but I'm going to make up for it this week. Bring it up right now. That is Pokemon Go. That is a mobile title. It is coming to Android and iOS next year. And once again, this is not part of Nintendo's mobile title initiative. I believe it is being published by the Pokemon Company. The developer is Niantic, who've done some other AR games, most notably on Android, came out recently on iOS as well. But that's what the game is. It is an augmented reality Pokemon game where you go out and walk around the real world and are able to hunt Pokemon and catch Pokemon and team up with other people to snag legendary Pokemon. But Nintendo is involved. They're actually making hardware for it, a thing called the Pokemon Go Plus that you wear on your wrist, and it connects to your mobile device via Bluetooth, and it vibrates or flashes and then tells you, oh, there's a Pokemon nearby or something like that. And Nintendo is actually making that, so they are heavily involved in this product. And it seems to be getting some pretty positive buzz. People are pretty excited about it.
Well, for a mobile game, it seems to really tie into the core of what Pokemon is, which is the gotta catch 'em all, kind of taking it to actual reality in a way. And it's also interesting to see, you know, my first thought was, well, obviously a lot of older fans love Pokemon, even though you could argue that aspects of it skew young. People grew up playing it and love it as much as I still love, you know, Mario. But the initial launch trailer for it, which was quite long and quite high on the production values. Mm-hmm. Really
it
focused
didn't really
on
show any of the gameplay, but it showed older folks, in their mid to late 20s, it seemed, going out and playing this Pokemon game.
And I believe it featured original first generation Pokemon, so it really seems to be tying into more of the nostalgia. Like here's the people who grew up playing these Pokemon. These are the Pokemon they'll remember, and we're aiming it at them because they're likely to have smartphones, whereas younger children, likely won't. So. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Kind of an interesting experiment all around, and the closest we've seen yet to kind of a more authentic Pokemon experience on a mobile device, as opposed to like a match 3 game or something.
Yeah, the thing that stands out as a little weird to me is that this Pokemon Go Plus thing is wearable. And as we know, the future is non-wearable.
Yeah, that's what Nintendo said about their quality of life devices, wasn't it? Which is, come to think of it, we haven't heard much about that in quite a while.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll hear about it again. Who knows? That might be history.
Yeah.
But another cool thing that we found out about, I think coming out of TGS, is some new details on the Nintendo 3DS game Project X Zone, or is it pronounced Project Cross Zone? Anyway, I'm going to call it Project X Zone 2. And the cool thing about it is, this has always been a collaboration between Namco and Sega and Capcom, and all these different characters are in there. Sometimes it's more obscure characters. Sonic the Hedgehog isn't in there, but characters from Valkyria Chronicles are. It's got Darkstalkers characters, a whole bunch of fun heroes from various games. But now there are some more Nintendo-specific characters that are joining the fray. We are getting Crom and Lucina from Fire Emblem, and Fiora from Xenoblade Chronicles.
Yeah, that was a cool little surprise. I never got a chance to play the first game. Did it come into the U.S.?
It did. I own it. I think I got, like, the collector's edition with the soundtrack. And yet I have not played it for some reason, despite the fact that, like, Mega Man and Darkstalkers and all these other characters I'm really fond of are in there. I just haven't had the time to play it.
I love these fan service-y crossover-type games, and I love the big old, love letter this game writes to sprite-based graphics.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So I'd always intended to try out the first one, but wasn't sure if it came over, and then I just kind of missed it. And to be honest, a lot of the more obscure characters in there I was aware of, but they weren't, like, favorites of mine. But now that you've got some Nintendo characters in there, I might actually have to check this one out.
Well, in addition to those characters, they've also bring in Cosmos from Xenosaga, and, even better, Segata Sanshiro.
Oh, my God.
The old Sega Saturn spokesperson from the commercials.
In Japan.
Yeah. Yeah, he was never had any presence in the U.S.
He was the guy in, like, the karate gi who would just throw people and make them explode.
Yeah, just like a dude who would make people explode. Exactly. And somehow he is a character in this game, and that, like, by default is going to make this, you know, the best game of 2016, even if Zelda comes out. It's ridiculous and crazy and looks totally awesome.
It's definitely on my watch list now.
So that's a cool title that we're going to get next year, but we've actually got some big releases right around the corner. As we're recording this podcast, we are on the cusp of a couple new big Nintendo items hitting stores.
That's right. Animal Crossing Happy Home Designer finally comes out on Friday.
Yeah, along with the cards.
That's right, the first Amiibo cards,
mm-hmm.
Which I still feel like I don't have a good sense for, how I'm going to get those, how difficult it's going to be, where they're at.
Well, I saw some for pre-order earlier this week at Walmart. There was a limit of 3 packs per customer, so you can get, how many is it per pack? It's like 6 cards per pack?
I think
pack.
It's 6 in America, yeah.
Yeah, so you can get, maybe, if you get no duplicates, 18 of those 400 cards, so you're well on your way.
I can't believe the whole point of the cards is collect them all, and they're having to put limits on them as well. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm at least going to buy a couple packs. I can't imagine I'll ever be able to afford or even hunt down the whole, 100 cards or whatever they're in the first set. I think set 2 is just coming out now in Japan. Mm. But yeah, I'm excited for that game, especially, I have a young daughter who's really a big fan of the series. I'm getting the NFC bundle that comes with the NFC attachment, which seems like it was announced years and years ago at this
yeah,
point.
It does.
It's finally coming out, and she'll be able to play it on the kind of the old 3DS I passed down to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little excited to check it out, too. But more excited, I'm actually for the Retro 3 pack of Amiibo that's coming
can't
out.
Can't wait to get my hands on that.
Pre-ordered that a while back, the GameStop exclusive, and it's finally coming out on Friday. Mr. Game & Watch, Duck Hunt Dog, and Rob the Robot.
Mm-hmm. Yep, pretty cool.
Can't wait to unlock those sprites in Mario Maker.
Yeah, for sure. And, I'm not sure if this game is really on the cusp of coming out, but, originally, Sega announced that 3D Sonic the Hedgehog 2 was going to be coming out in September. And we only have, one Thursday left in September. So if they stick true to that, that game's going to be out, either, pretty much immediately, or that means it's falling into October, I guess. But I hope it comes out, because Sonic 2 was a fantastic game on Genesis, and all of these 3D classics have been pretty much amazing. And I can't wait to give it another spin on the 3DS, all enhanced with some new features and 3D graphics.
I still need to catch up on some of the other Sega 3D classics. I always wanted to get the Streets of Rage titles and just haven't for some reason.
Yeah, Streets of Rage ones are great. Gunstar is great. A lot of the pseudo 3D arcade games are great. I still wish they'd do Golden Axe. But yeah, it's really good stuff. It's kind of sad that it's some of the best stuff that Sega's done years, but it's all technically old games.
Yeah.
kind of ironic.
Sad, but at the same time, you're happy to see them back.
Yeah, but there's so much nostalgia in that. I was looking at Super Thunderblade earlier, and I'm like, oh man, you're just seeing these retro fonts that they use that are so closely tied to the Genesis, really took me back.
Yeah.
But speaking of Sonic, Sonic Boom Fire and Ice was also, they recently announced that's been delayed until next year, and I certainly don't think that Star Fox Zero, is going to have, you know, same kind of problems that Sonic has had. But I would assume this has been delayed for quality reasons as well. We know that Sonic could always use some extra time under development, it seems. So that's probably a good thing.
Yeah. I think the best Sonic game that I've played in years is when I put the Sonic costume on Mario in Mario Maker.
Generations was really, really good.
Yeah, I never tried that out, actually, and I meant to. I'm just you know, half-joking with my little Sonic trolling.
There's actually some really decent games that came out recently. They're available right now. You can play them. I just want to give some quick impressions on those. One of those being the long-awaited update to Shovel Knight. That's the Plague of Shadows.
Yeah.
I don't want to call it DLC. I mean,
well,
it's
DLC. Free DLC.
Yeah, it's free DLC. I mean, that was a stretch goal. They added a new playable character. There's still, you know, more playable characters to come. But, you know, I've played that a little bit, not quite as much as I like. But it's really, really impressive now that I've gone hands-on with it, just how much it changes up the game and how much it adds. You know, controlling Plague Knight is nuts. He's got this double jump and then this charge-up jump that either, you know, launches him straight up or, you know, this huge arc across the screen. And it's a bit finicky to control. I mean, if this were just the basic game mode, I'd be like, oh, man, what are they done? This is, you know, really crazy and hard to control, and it'd be hard to get behind. But as a bonus mode, and, you know, normally you don't get this until you've played through the game of Shovel Knight, so you kind of know what the game is all like. You mm-hmm. understand the game world.
You've got your skills up.
Yeah, and then this is like, you know, a very advanced mode to play, and it's good to, you know, have the other experience, because if you went into this first, you'd be like, oh, man, this is just out of control.
I read a developer blog about this, and they said that the goal with Plague Knight and the way he moves through the world was to create this feeling that you were always on the edge, that he was mm-hmm. always kind of out of control.
Yeah, he is.
And it sounds like, from what you've described to me, that they definitely delivered that.
And if you take a hit, he bounces back a lot, so it can be really easy to be knocked into a pit or somewhere you don't want to be. It's nuts. And he's got all these, you know, different weapons, the bomb casings, the kind of explosions, the way they bounce. You know, just so much to explore. And, you know, they've redesigned the levels. There's new parts to the levels added in, so you can go to places that didn't exist when it was just Shovel Knight, when you're playing as Shovel Knight. And, you know, it's very extensive and very fun. And there's a secret code if you, you know, haven't finished the game of Shovel Knight. You just want to dive right into crazy, nutso Plague Knight mode.
I bet this is the kind of character where people are going to do these amazing super play videos with them, where they're using and abusing those new abilities to just, you know, make a mockery of these levels.
Yeah, I mean, I could really see getting into the groove and being able to do all kinds of insane stuff. I should also mention that when you throw your projectiles in the air, that adds like a hover. So you can like get tons of crazy air and just, you know, fly through these stages. But I think it does take a little bit of practice. It's not something that you're going to do immediately.
Well, it sounds like it might be a little tricky to get the hang of, but I'm super looking forward to, you know, a return trip to that game, because mm-hmm. Shovel Knight was definitely one of the best games I'd played in quite a while when it came out, and I'd be playing the update right now if it wasn't for freaking Mario Maker and Metal Gear on the PS4 sucking all of my time away.
I guess there is a little bit of bad news with Shovel Knight, and that is it looks like the retail package version has been pushed back. Originally, it was an October release. The latest I've seen is November. I don't think that Yacht Club Games has officially commented on it, but it looks like it's been you know, pushed back somewhat. Still, we've got our download version, so we can play the new campaign and all that good stuff.
But, I've seen I guess some word of the Shovel Knight amiibo. Mm-hmm. You know, going on presale in some other territories.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Nothing here yet, I don't think.
You actually pre-ordered a UK version, like, right after it was announced. So I wonder if that's what they're doing, is they're going to have that come out the same time that the retail game does or something.
Maybe.
I'm looking forward to hearing an official word.
Yeah.
So now I'd like to talk about our favorite news topic, and of course, I mean boobs.
I had the amiibo queue all set to go.
And I'm referring, of course, to the recent release of Senran Kagura 2 Deep Crimson, which came out on the 3DS. Unlike the first game, this was a retail release and a digital release. And you know, I've been playing it a little bit. The original game was a beat-em-up brawler with lots of bosoms. And the second game is more of the same. But the thing that I need to emphasize about Senran Kagura is it's not just about the fun bags. There's actually a pretty deep story, and they give, you know, lots of characterization to the heroes of this game, and the villains for that matter. And they, you know, blur the line between, you know, which ones are good and which ones are evil. And there's just a lot more to it than what people might expect. But the other thing about it is that, you know, there is a gameplay component as well. You know, it's not just, you know, watching the fan service. And the first game was super duper repetitive. I mean, no matter which character I was playing as, it was always, you know, do a simple combo, knock him into the air, then, you know, pummel guys with, you know, infinite juggles, not jugs, juggles. And it seemed like it was that's what you would do with every level of the game, was just doing that ad infinitum, and it got super repetitive for that kind of game. And I'm really happy to say that they've really made things more interesting with the sequel. The first one, you know, it played very much like a 2D game, and it feels weird to say, because normally when it comes to brawlers, I would always say, yeah, 2D is better than 3D, it just works better. But with this one, they've clearly gone more of a 3D beat-em-up route, and the way that that benefits the game is it makes it, gives it much more dynamic level design. You're running around much more interesting levels. Sometimes you're running, you know, forward or backward, or just, you know, the perspective is changing. It's it just makes it more fun and gives it more depth. And I haven't spent enough time with the combat system to see if it really pays off in the long run. But my early impressions are that it's a big step past the first game, and it could actually be pretty cool. So if you like beat-em-ups or you like Hooters, you know, it's worth checking it out.
Well, knowing you know, that you're such a big fan of brawlers, going all the way back to the Final Fight 16-bit days, mm-hmm. That makes me think maybe I'll check this out. At first glance, it did just look like, you know, some, you know, crazy semi-soft porn Japanese game.
I mean that's there. That is clearly a huge selling point. And when I say huge, I mean in more ways than one. They're actually comically large. It's ridiculous. but yeah, there is more to it than that. And, you know, seems promising.
Cool.
Very promising. That was a lot of news. So I think we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the crazy world of game reviews. All right, we are back, and we are here to discuss the world of game reviews, something that we are very experienced with, something we had to deal with constantly as part of Nintendo Power, as well as the other publications that we've worked on, and something that, you know, can be, you know, controversial at times. You know, people, it seems, you know, a lot of people have different opinions on what video game reviews should be, how scores should be doled out. So we thought, hey, let's make that our topic this week. So tell me, Slate, you know, what's your, you know, opinion on this whole matter?
Yeah, it's reviews, and I can tell you, having worked on, just like you know, having worked on so many different games magazines over, you know, decades, and this is something we always were constantly kind of evolving our opinion on. And, you know, at times I've argued completely different sides and in terms of the best way to approach a review, the best scoring system, and we tried so many out. And, you know, I think at heart of it, the heart of the problem is that a review, kind of by definition, is you're telling people, you know, exactly what they should think. Obviously, people can read a review and just see it as the reviewer's own opinion. But, you know, a lot of the times, especially with aggregate sites these days, even if you're talking about non-gaming reviews like Rotten Tomatoes, you know, people just tend to look at that score and maybe they don't dig much deeper. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're kind of putting a brand on something. And in any case, games, movies, whatever you're talking about, there are technical issues you can point out, but largely it's always going to be subjective. So you're trying
to, it's very much a matter of opinion.
Yeah, so you're trying to keep that in mind, and you're also trying to keep in mind your own personal preferences and juggle that with what you think the audience expects and is looking for. And you're trying to kind of articulate, you know, feelings around that and assign a number to it. So it's kind of a broken system, and I kind of really, you know, on the one hand, I kind of appreciate and understand the occasional site that will go rogue and say, look, we're not putting a score with our reviews. You have to read the full thoughts because we just don't think that's fair. But as a consumer, as someone who reads reviews, I really appreciate the score. And I appreciate going to Rotten Tomatoes even and to an aggregate site and getting a sense for whether this is a movie I might like or not. So, yeah, there's always that. It's a tricky balance in trying to figure out exactly, you know, what people need to know and you know, what you should tell them and how you should weigh it all. You know, it's always a tricky thing. And, you know, going all the way back to when I was on Game Players, you know, I remember back then the British press, British games magazines especially, were notorious for giving, you know, really harsh, you know, reviews to bad games. And when our company eventually became part of Future, or what would become Future, and they kind of sent some of their editors down to talk to us about, you know, the changes they wanted in the magazine. And one of the things they said specifically was, you know, it's kind of a good thing, basically, if you can throw in at least one rotten egg into your review section each month, because it makes for entertaining reading if you can really just, you know, bash it and go to town in kind of comical ways. And, you know, so we kind of got involved in that stuff, you know, for a time until, you know, it just started to feel like, you know, I don't know. I'm always thinking, at the same time people may their heart pay good money for this stuff, and, you know, we kind of need to call out bad stuff when we see it. Also, nobody, or very rarely do people set out to make a bad game. They don't want to kick somebody while they're down, or, you know, it seems like the wrong time to be making jokes.
It's true, and that's something that we, you know, we're cognizant of at Nintendo Power especially. You know, if a game is just going to be crap and people don't really care about it, you know, it was the kind of thing that we just probably wouldn't bother to review. On the other hand, you know, throwing in a bad score really legitimizes the whole range of scores that you have. And that's one of the biggest problems I have with game reviews and game scores, is that there doesn't seem to be a real consensus on what scores mean. And, you know, some places, you know, it means something different than it does at other outlets. And, you know, at Nintendo Power, I felt like, you know, we really wanted, you know, that whole range to mean something. It didn't always end up being that way, because, you know, if a game, a lot of the games that would have scored, you know, like a 1 or a 2 or a 3 or a 4, maybe even a 5, we'd be like, this is a waste of our time. We only have so many people and so many hours and so many games that we can review in a month. So, you know, these lower scoring games that people just are probably not going to play anyway, we're not going to bother with those. And that's why, you know, things would skew towards, you know, 6s and 7s and 8s and 9s. But it's always really tricky because, you know, some people insist that a 7 is like an average, middle-of-the-road game, and I just hate that idea. I can't stand that idea. You know, why you would ever only rate games on a 5 to 10 scale. I don't get why you would have a rating scale like that. And, you know, I do kind of get, oh, well, you know, that's how it works in school, but, you know, for crying out loud, we're not in school. We're a video game magazine. We're completely the opposite of school. And, you know, I know that, you know, when I was growing up, I was reading publications like EGM, and that was certainly the opinion that they had. They took that and point out, you know, 5 is average score. You know, we're talking about mathematical averages, not, you know, average performance. That's how this works out. And it always made sense to me. Whereas Game Informer, it's like, you know, if you give a game a 7, they think that's, you know, like a C game, and it's not very good. And that's just crazy that, like, you know, 7.5 or under is a garbage game, and like only an 8 or above matters, and that bugs me to no end.
Yeah, it's tough to buck that trend though, because if you suddenly start giving things 5s when they're getting 7.5s or whatever in other magazines, then the reader's going to read that very differently.
Well, right. Also, plus when it goes on to an aggregate, you know, if you're basically taking different kinds of scores and mashing them up, you know, it doesn't really work.
Yeah, not that this is the primary concern of a reviewer, but as a side note, a lot of game publishers and stuff started basing like bonuses to the developers and stuff off of what aggregate scores they got. So, you know, that's kind of crazy. I've gone back and forth over so many. I mean, during my career, I've used percentage scales where literally like down to the decimal point, you know, you could give something like a 98.3% or something.
It's not quite 98.4%. Sorry.
I know. Down to like a 10 scale, down to, you know, having, you know, halves, 10.5, 9.5, not 10.5, obviously. That'd be a pretty amazing game. 9.5, you know, 7.5, to just having, you know, kind of a 5-star scale. And I kind of am in favor, you know, if I were reviewing games today, more in favor of that, because it's a little bit more, you know, it's less specific, and I feel like you've got a little bit more wiggle room as a reviewer to give something, to kind of put it in the appropriate spot. And like you said, if no one's going to use 1 through 5 on a 10 scale anyway, might as well just go with 5 stars.
Well, kind of. I mean, does that carry over? Does that mean that everything has to get, like, you know, 4 stars or 5 stars?
Yeah.
But I do like that I think you are more likely to use the full review scale when it's only got like 4 stars or 5 stars. You know, from a reviewer's perspective anyway.
At the very least, you know that the do not buy this game scores are 1 star and 2 star. If you get a 3 star and you're like a big, if you're a big Dragon Ball fan and right. the new Dragon Ball game got 3 stars, you probably think, oh, that's safe enough. And 4 stars and above, you know, it's great. So, yeah, that makes a little more sense.
So you said you've used a lot of different review score scales. Did you have a preference? I think the 10 is the best?
Well, I guess, you know, for the most part, I probably used like, you know, the 10 scale, you know, with halves. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fine insofar as even though it's off kilter and, you know, you usually don't use 1 through 5. I think the readers kind of know what this stuff inherently means. You know, they kind of know that even a 7.5 isn't the best, you know, game out there, even though technically...
Yeah, but it's not supposed to be a bad game. We never intended that for, you know, to be a bad game.
Right.
If the game gets a 7, it's still, you know, a pretty fun game. It's still pretty decent. Just, you know, it's got some issues, but that is a fairly recommended game.
I feel like it's not, though, because in a world where there's no shortage... I mean, unless you're mega rich and you buy up pretty much everything, there's usually no shortage of 8s and 9s out there.
Wait, so are you suddenly falling on the 7.5 and below is crap?
No.
You have no business being our EIC. This is why we went out of business.
No, I agree with you. 7.5 should be good, but I kind of feel like it's not good enough. Like, it's a deeper cut. Again, it's like I have to really like kind of the genre or the brand or whatever to go for a 7.5 over, you know, an 8 or a 9 or a 10.
Well, and probably aren't going to pick a 7.5 over an 8 or a 9.
Right. And I guess
it's still a game that's good.
It's good, but it's obviously not a standout. I feel like there's enough volume in gaming, and I think this is what – and again, this gets back to reader expectations. I think, you know, people expect – you know, they're looking for 8s and 9s. You know, when I'm perusing, Rotten Tomatoes, trying to figure out if I want to see a movie this weekend, I'm looking for stuff that got ideally 70, 80, 90. You know, and even though a 60, I think something is still technically a fresh tomato. It's mm-hmm. it's down there on the list. You know, just obvious reaction, I suppose. But let me ask you a specific question here. If we're talking about a 10 scale, or I guess even if we're talking about 5 stars, how stingy were you with 10s or with 5s?
I was super stingy. I pretty much never gave out a 10. I mean, for me, you know, a 10 means there are no significant issues for me to point out. If I have to say, oh, you know, this is a big, you know, this is a notable problem that needs to be corrected, there's no way in good conscience I could give it a 10. It doesn't mean it has to be perfect, but, you know, for me, there are no big issues I have to overlook and say, you know, this should have been corrected before this game was released. So I don't think I ever gave one out at Nintendo Power. There are games I would have given them to if had I been the reviewer. Galaxy and Galaxy 2 specifically stand out. And I blame you and Chris Shepard for not giving those games 10s.
I agree the first one, the one Shepard reviewed, should have gotten a 10. And I probably should have given the second one a 10. But
Wait. We just talked about Mario like last week, and you like Galaxy 2 better than Galaxy 1, yet somehow you wouldn't give it a 10?
Well, here was the thing. Galaxy 2, I felt like one of the key things for me at the time with Galaxy 1 was it was so fresh and original.
Mm-hmm.
And Galaxy 2 really was more like a level expansion pack. So I kind of dinged it for that, but that's a very good point.
That's what I was thinking it was going to be going in, but after I played, I'm like, no way, this is totally a 10. Slate blew it.
Well, here's also the thing, and this is maybe another subject about, you know, from a reviewer's perspective, is I would give most Mario games and most Zelda games 10s. So I'm kind of fighting against that when I review it, because I don't feel like that fits in with the expected norm or the way most people would approach a review. Because for me, even the ones that have some, you know, issues.
Oh, so you're one of those biased reviewers, huh? I see how it is.
Well, no, that's just it. I'm actively trying not to be biased, because to me, Mario's my favorite series, and I feel like when it's working well, it's working above and beyond what I would expect from a 9 or a 10 game in another genre or another franchise. So I can see a few, you know, flaws, maybe even a couple of rough patches in a game that does so much stuff you know, amazingly well and still feel like that deserves a top score. But at the same time, and also, this is, I'm kind of going off on tangents here, but when you're specifically looking at something like a Mario or Zelda, are you kind of comparing it to the general state of, you know, is it, you know, nine scores are comparative things. Is this a nine because most of the other games out there of a certain quality comparatively? Or are you looking at this Mario game compared to all the past Mario games? In which case, that's difficult because you're looking at a storied franchise that's filled with amazingly, you know, highly scored games, and you're comparing it not necessarily to what people could reasonably expect on the platform of today, but you're comparing it to a whole history of top titles.
Well, that's also why you have to, you know, use that entire, you know, review scale. I mean, maybe, you know, that upper tier, you know, is kind of reserved for maybe the Marios and the Zeldas of the world. Those are things that are going to get, you know, nines and 9.5s. That's why you got to, you know, be judicious with dishing those out, and don't be afraid to give, you know, lesser quality games a lower score. That's what makes those top scores meaningful, especially when you get around to giving a game a 10. But, you know, you have this, you know, review scale in your publication, and, you know, all these games are getting, you know, compared to each other on these same scales. I mean, we ran, you know, a review archive where it, you know, showed all these games compared next to each other. And, you know, those are all using the same scale, so obviously, you know, you have to compare them all to one another. You know, as I, you know, just said, you know, the really good stuff, it'll always get those high numbers. And, you know, sometimes you'll see anomalies because, you know, different reviewers have different opinions and stuff. But if it's all on the same scale, you know, you have to, you know, weigh that all relative to each other. That's why, you know, we did the downloadable reviews. We did switch to a different scale because I didn't want, you know, some, you know, small, you know, $2 game experience to be, you know, rated on the same scale as, you know, some big, deep, you know, 50-hour epic. It just doesn't seem fair. And, you know, for that, we would just do a recommended, not recommended, or if it was in the middle. And, you know, for the most part, I think that worked out pretty well, because then we could still give a game a recommendation. We could say, yeah, this is really good, but, you know, we don't have to say, like, oh, it's getting an 8. And it's like, but, you know, Super Paper Mario got an 8. Are you saying it's as good as Super Paper Mario? I'm like, no. So, you know, we would just, you know, we went on a different scale because I think that worked pretty well. I mean, sometimes you would get, you know, a complete console quality title on downloads. And we never actually hit that at Nintendo Power because we were gone before that ever happened. But, you know, we get these, you know, full-fledged games that, you know, only existed in downloadable form, you know, like the first Cinnamon Kagura, Ace Attorney. I mean, there was stuff like, you know, Cave Story, or, you know, maybe the Rebirth games, things that, you know, could have easily been on, you know, a full scale, and that would have been totally fine and fair. But, you know, a lot of it's not. And so that just seemed like the wise way to go. But, yeah, I mean, all that stuff, you are comparing it to each other. So, you know, if it, you know, needs to be on a different scale, you know, that's the way to do it. And, you know, we didn't have, like, a different scale for Mario or Zelda. They didn't go off and be like, yep, we're going to review these all on their own on the special Mario scale. You know, Super Paper Mario, compared to the other ones, it's not so good. It only gets a 6 or something like that. No way.
Yeah, I think that's an especially tough problem when you're talking about Nintendo consoles, which, you know, for the last, you know, many, many years, don't tend to have a lot of an overabundance of quality third-party software compared to what you get from the first party. So, you know, it's always tough to say, like, you know, how do you, it's a very uneven landscape of gaming, I guess I should say, that, you know, is the highs and the lows a lot of the times. And when you're talking about the highs, we're rating, you know, the latest Mario and Luigi RPG, you know, and the latest Smash Brothers, the latest Mario Kart. Nintendo first-party stuff tends to score very well. So it's, you know, it was tough sometimes to figure out the nuances of exactly how they all stacked up against each other.
Yeah, I mean, I would, you know, certainly, you know, think about it quite a bit. I have to look at my previous scores. You know, I tried to, you know, kind of have some personal ranking. Yes, this is better than this. This is about the same as this, so it deserves the same score. Didn't always work out perfectly, but it was something that I really, really tried to keep in mind because, you know, these are people that are spending their hard-earned money, hopefully somewhat based on our reviews. So it was really important to try to get this thing right. You know, we want to, you know, be able to help the reader as much as possible.
Yeah, and to answer my own question from before, I think I feel like tens could be used a bit more. You know, obviously, in that example you gave, I felt like I was handcuffed, and I shied away from giving it to some games that I might have. My inclination would have been to just do nothing but gush about them, but I feel like 10 to me just means, obviously, and you didn't say that it meant perfect, but it's obviously
right.
not perfect.
It's not.
I feel like it just means highest possible recommendation, and you know, you take something like Smash Brothers. I think we mentioned this on a previous podcast, but mm-hmm. I reviewed the Wii version of that game.
Yep.
And, you know, despite the fact that hardcore tournament players prefer Melee and stuff like that, I still felt like for everything that a Smash Brothers games give you, they just go above and beyond with the modes and the characters and the nostalgic Nintendo love and everything. I just felt like that game was a 10 to me. It just blew me away. Now, I scored it as such, but then...
Well, it had a huge broken component, as we discussed last time.
Yeah, but we didn't know that until after
right.
it came out, which is, you know, an inherent problem with trying to, you know, review games on...
It's a problem with print and lead times. Yeah.
Yeah, or even online, people still run into that sometimes.
Yeah,
until
especially
a game is,
these days when they're, you know, patching games after the fact and
yeah.
they're doing these last-minute tweaks and stuff, like with Mario Maker, you know?
The way you're never ensure that, entirely sure that what you tested during the review process is what people in the long
yeah,
run are actually going to be exposed to. But, you know, it's here's another kind of argument. We touched on this a little bit in the past as well, but I'll bring it up here on this reviews topic. I still don't feel too bad about that. I mean, about that 10 score for Smash. If I could go back, I would probably lower it a little bit just because it seems like that's the right thing to do. But to be honest, at that time when it came out, I personally wasn't that interested in playing Smash Online, and online gaming wasn't like a de facto thing every game needed to have back then. So I felt like if they'd never even put that feature in the game, it probably would have positively affected that score. I guess what I'm saying is it would have been better not to have it than to have kind of a rough version of it.
I don't know. With that game, I feel like, you know, at this point in time, online multiplayer was pretty darn important, and it kind of needed to be in that game. At the same time, it needed to totally work. So, yeah, that would have totally knocked the score down for me, whether it was missing or whether it was broken. That's me. And, you know.
Yeah. Well, each reviewer has their own outlook.
Exactly.
I think at that time, online multiplayer was more important than maybe I give it credit for, but primarily on other systems.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you were a Nintendo gamer with a Nintendo system, your expectations were maybe a little bit different. Hmm. And Smash, particularly, being one of those, like Mario Kart, one of those primarily, you know, on-the-couch multiplayer games. But on the opposite, sorry, go ahead.
But speaking of games that got 10s, there actually was one game that I did give a you know, not, I guess, perfect score, because at that time I was actually on a rating scale of a 4 out of 4. I was at Play Magazine, and for like a month or two we had gone to a 4-star scale. Because, you know, like we were talking about earlier, it seems, you know, just easier to use in some ways. But the readers apparently hated it. But anyway, during that time, I reviewed Metal Gear Solid 3 Snake Eater and gave it a 4 out of 4. So I think that's the only professional review where I've ever given a game top marks. When it came out on the 3DS, it did not get top marks. It you know, had some frame rate issues and stuff like that.
Mm.
But also might have just been because, you know, we were on a bigger review scale. And so, you know, whereas a 4 out of 4 would be justified... You know, a 9 out of 10 was also justified, or a 9.5 out of 10 or whatever. I really like that game on 3DS. But
have you ever given a score that you regretted later?
Yes, definitely. I can't think of any immediately when it comes to Nintendo stuff, but I was reviewing a game for Play, and it was Ark the Lad Collection, and... Play Magazine had kind of just started up. It, you know, I hadn't really figured out what the review scale was like, so I had to, you know, ask about it. They also weren't doing half stars at the time. And, you know, I'm like, okay, so, you know, what are some of the other games getting in this issue? And back at that time, that was around when Metal Gear Solid 2 came out. I'm not sure why Metal Gear keeps coming up. But Metal Gear Solid 2 was reviewed that issue, and it got 4 stars. And I was like, well, there's no way that, you know, the Lad Collection is in that ballpark. I do really like the game. It's really cool. But it had lots of, you know, cool extras in the package. You know, it was like, you know, 3 or 4 games in one, depending on how you want to qualify one of the discs on there. And I ended up giving it 3 out of 5, which, you know, equates to like 60%. And if you just look at that 60%, and especially if you see like an aggregate site, you're like, wow, this game did really poorly, but I didn't want it to be that way at all. I wanted it to be, you know, this game was actually really good. And yeah, just mathematically didn't work out the way I intended. And I probably should have given it like 4 and just like mentioned, hey, if you know, you're not into all this, you know, deluxe packaging and extra stuff, you know, just consider this, you know, knock a star off my review. And I definitely would have given it a 3.5 if they were doing, you know, halves. But yeah, it was you know, it had to be either a 3 or a 4 on this scale, and it ended up being a mess for me. So I do regret that one in particular.
I've got a couple. One was, speaking of Metal Gear, it was Metal Gear Solid 2. when I was on PlayStation Magazine, PSM, we scored the first U.S. review of that game. So I was playing it completely blind. I actually included a whole strategy guide in that issue and somehow managed not to miss the twist or mention the twist, which I was very proud of. But I just think the game hasn't aged terribly well. At the time, it was so revolutionary and so technically impressive, and they added so many more abilities that Snake could do over the original Metal Gear Solid that really expanded the gameplay, that I was blown away and didn't see the faults as much as I would now, and ended up giving it a 10. And but now looking back on it, I appreciate what it did for the series historically, but I think it's one of the more overwrought kind of you know, just kind of storytelling.
It's a Nintendo podcast or a Metal Gear podcast? I can't even tell.
Well, back to Nintendo, my other one is, and I've mentioned this in the pages of Nintendo Power.
Oh, yes.
Was Yoshi's Island.
That's right. You'll never live that one down.
This is when I was on Game Player, so I would have been pretty young, and I guess, in as a feeble defense that I'm offering. I believe I gave it a 75. I think even maybe of a 75% on a 100-point scale or whatever crazy thing we were using back then. And which is no, you know, not a bad score, but I remember getting it, and it was being billed back then as Super Mario World 2. Mm-hmm. And Super Mario World then was my favorite all-time game, and I just I think named it on last week's podcast as my favorite Mario game, possibly still my favorite all-time game. So I was heavily expecting it to play just like Super Mario World, and when I got Yoshi's Island and saw it for what it really was, and it wasn't originally called Super Mario World 2 in Japan,
right?
I had trouble kind of adjusting to it and appreciating it for its own unique qualities. And, so I gave it a decent score, but ultimately just kind of had some lame reasons for kind of docking it a few points.
Well, I thought you claimed that like one of the problems was that the graphics looked the same as Mario World and it hadn't evolved at all, you know, since that first game had been released all those years previous, I would like to point out is completely insane.
Well, that was another, lame point I made was that at that time, you know, graphics were still super important, you know, to a lot of people. And I got too wrapped up in that. And at the time, remember, the graphics were switching more to the pre-rendered sprites. We had Donkey Kong Country at the time. Mm-hmm. Donkey Kong Country hasn't aged well visually. But back then, it was like, oh, my God, this looks like a computer come to life or something.
Yeah,
Killer
Yoshi's
Instinct
Island
was doing
had
it.
This, you know, really creative, you know, sketch art style.
It did, and I appreciate it now. But at the time, even though it was a creative style for sure, it wasn't technically impressive. And that's, you know, I was sitting there playing Donkey Kong Country 1 minute and then going back to this, which looked a little aged in the moment. But, you know, I'm just kind of explaining why I had that opinion. I can't really defend it because it was, you know, it was historically wrong. Anyway, I got a chance in Nintendo Power in the playback section.
That's right. I think I barked at you about that for quite a while, and you finally got around to repenting.
Yeah, I kind of brought up the whole subject and told that story in Nintendo Power and kind of kind of made my amends and my apologies to the game. And I did go back several years after, or maybe even a couple years after I reviewed it and played through it again and kind of experienced it with fresh eyes and was just blown away by how great it was.
So when you were reviewing a game, is there anything that you would, you know, weigh you know, more heavily than another thing? What ultimately went into giving a game the score that it got?
Well, I'll tell you, I think there's a lot of factors and a lot of things you can look at when you're trying to justify a score. But for me, and I think for most people that I worked with, the first score just kind of comes from your gut. And then you start looking at all the supposed criteria you could apply and see if you can justify that gut score, and you kind of adjust it maybe a little bit up or down. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of the times you'd think, you know, okay, well, this is an amazing game, but it's just a slightly more refined version of the same game they put out last year or the year before. You know, that was always a problem with sports games or with, you know, the old original Tomb Raider games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how often could you kind of basically give the same game the same score before you started docking points?
Mm-hmm.
You know, from one perspective, it's like, well, you know, you don't want to pay, you know, the same money over again for a game that's mm-hmm. largely the same as what you had last year.
But if you haven't played that one before and you're new to the franchise,
exactly.
You know, then what do you do?
This is that you want people to think the newest one is the best
one,
if it mm-hmm. is. So that one's a hard
one.
Also, you know, people tend to want to see innovation more than it actually mattered, to be honest. You know, very rarely did you see a truly original game. But we kind of looked for it in little pockets wherever we could find it, and that always mattered. You know, that's probably led us to really rave about games like Parappa the Rapper on PlayStation, which technically was pretty unsound. I mean, it's a rhythm game where if we're keeping the correct rhythm kind of makes you fail, but it was super charming and very fresh.
Yeah, that game benefited, you know, it wasn't necessarily from the gameplay. It was from a lot of other aspects as well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
For there, it's like, I guess that one is one where things are kind of out of balance, and that maybe just the charm and the story and the art style mattered more than the actual gameplay.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are games, too, where you can try to break it down part by part. I remember a lot of Grand Theft Auto titles were like this, especially Grand Theft Auto 3, the first one to kind of establish the series as we know it today.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, that one was kind of janky and awkward in a lot of ways,
yeah.
But people didn't care. They're like, oh man, you can, you know, run over hoes. So
well that game, yeah, and that game was a great example of how a game could be more than the sum of its parts, because taken individually and broken down, the driving, you know, wasn't a great driving game. The shooting mechanics weren't great, but you put all that stuff together in just the right mix and it was amazing. So
yeah.
You know, it could be really tough with games, and you know, in trying to balance again.
Yeah, I mean, it was always a different balancing
the criteria.
Act on you know, different games. I mean, for me, you called it a gut instinct. For me, it's just like, you know, what do I feel, you know, is the level of fun? How much fun am I getting out of this game? That would ultimately be, you know, how I would decide, you know, what I would give a game. You know, it's a scale from 0 to 10 on fun, basically.
Yeah. The fun factor, as GamePro would put it.
Yeah. And I guess another way you could put it is, you know, just how good is the gameplay? Because, you know, for me, ultimately how it played was, you know, more important than the, you know, the graphics or the length or anything like that. But it was, you know, it would totally, you know, be a balancing act, and it would vary wildly from game to game. Again, I hate that I'm, you know, getting away from Nintendo stuff, but one of my favorite games from last generation was Nier, which, you know, on a gameplay scale, you know, it's all right, but, you know, like the music and the story were so amazing that, you know, I absolutely loved it in spite of its flaws, and I would give it, you know, crazy high marks if I'd ever reviewed that title.
But, yeah, you can, certain things like that can overcome bad gameplay, but I will say, I think you touched on a point just a second ago, too, that unlike movies and music, where you can appreciate good production values, but ultimately sometimes, you know, lo-fi stuff can get the sound that you want. Games are inherently have a very technical component.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the interactivity portion of it that makes gaming unique also is very much a science that you can
mm-hmm.
break down and evaluate. So
mm-hmm.
I think that's where, you know, in a lot of those times, that's where it's not so much gut and
mm-hmm.
just overall impressions as it is kind of more of a technical grade.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there are some games where I would really, really enjoy them, and then there would just be parts where I would come across, you know, some horrible frame rate issues or something. I'm just like, you know what? There is no way in good conscience I can give this game a 9 or whatever just because this aspect is so, you know, technically broken. And, you know, I would really love to be able to rate it higher, but, you know, I just can't.
And like you told me once before, the difference between a good beat-em-up and a bad beat-em-up is that small little subtle moment of the connection of when you strike an opponent,
mm-hmm.
you know, what does it kind of feel like? You know, it's this specific timing And and when you're talking about a fighting game like Street Fighter, it's the number of frames, you know, in which something connects versus the number of frames maybe you're invincible. It's all those little nuanced things that are very, very specific decisions on the part of the developer that add up to how it feels and plays. And you can have the world's most grandiose looking kind of brawler with an amazing feature set, but if that moment of connection isn't there, then it's not going to score high.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, is there anything that we can take away from all of this?
Well, I think it's that when you hear people complain or discuss, reviews in the games press, to me the takeaway is kind of everyone's right, no matter what their point of view is. It is in some ways an archaic, maddening, alchemic thing. But it's also kind of necessary, and as much as we complain about the nuances of it, we kind of all want it, and you know there's good use for it. So I just always find that whenever it comes up, it's an interesting discussion to hear or be a part of.
Well, I don't think I have anything to add beyond that. Very well said, my friend, or my lackey, I should say.
Oh.
So I think we'll wrap it up there. But before we go, I think it's time for a dramatic reading. This time from the back of the box of Super Glove Ball. Super Glove Ball reaches a new dimension in gameplay. Now you can really reach in and grab the action. Super Glove Ball bridges the gap between game and reality by giving you the sensation of real depth, regardless of which controller you use. Throw, catch, punch and swerve through a maze of rooms, progressing up spiraling skill levels towards your ultimate goal. Along the way, you'll experience amazing dimensional effects as you ricochet the ball off walls to knock out tiles, blocks, and adversaries. Super Glove Ball is extraordinary, even when you use an ordinary joystick, but only the Power Glove gives you true intuitive control. When you use the Power Glove, your every move is echoed by the glove on screen. It's like mind-melding with the game. Only Super Glove Ball gives you the ultimate Power Glove experience.
Can I just say that last sentence is probably true? It probably was the ultimate Power Glove experience, and can I also say that it was utter garbage?
I don't think I ever played it, but I will point out that the phrase intuitive control is in quotes. So,
yeah.
Apparently, even.
Asterix, not
Mattel,
actually intuitive.
Even Mattel wasn't sure.
I can tell you, I appeared in a Mattel Power Glove promotional video and when I was just a wee lad. And I had to actually sit there and not only play with the Power Glove on video, but come up with tips for each major NES game, tips that somehow showed you how the Power Glove made gaming even better. And it was an impossible task.
I hope that's up on YouTube.
It is on YouTube. And it's the thing was terrible. My arm got tired really fast, and it makes every game less intuitive. I hate the Power Glove on record. I finally get my vengeance after so many years. Well, all right, that's it for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com, and you can follow us at PowerProsPod on both Facebook and Twitter. You can also follow The Hoff on Twitter at Chris The Hoff, and I'm at Chris Slate. Hoff also has a super cool blog called Still Playing With Power, which you can find at christhehoff.tumblr.com. Email us for any reason at powerprospod@gmail.com, and hey, if you get a second and you like the podcast, we'd surely appreciate it if you pop by iTunes and give us a nice little rating.
Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Chris Slate.
See ya.
And our super funky friend, Funky Kong. We will see you next time.